Usually, when you get some kind of modern diagnosis, there's this expectation of like clinical precision.
Right, like a chart or a scan.
Yeah, exactly. A doctor runs a blood test, or maybe they order an MRI and then they point to a screen and say, right there, that's the problem.
Right.
But if you're a mom or a dad, or honestly just anyone trying to navigate the absolute whirlwind that is 2026, you and I actually share a common baseline condition right now.
We really do.
And it's this creeping, persistent feeling of just being completely overwhelmed and, well, wildly under-resourced for the tasks sitting right in front of us.
Yeah, it really has become the universal baseline. I mean, we are all running on empty, but the treadmill just seems to keep speeding up anyway. Like,
Right.
the required output of our daily lives feels like it's constantly increasing, but our internal capacity stays exactly the same. Or, maybe it even shrinks.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it shrinks. And that diagnosis is exactly what we are digging into today. Because as you get ready for your Connect group at Harmony Christian Church this week, we want to, help you prep by unpacking Pastor Kent Wagner's Mother's Day sermon.
Which was so good.
So good. It's from his series, Finding Margin in the Madness. But the thing that struck me right away about Kent's approach here was that he didn't just like stand up and offer a generic pep talk.
Yeah, no platitudes.
Exactly. He didn't just look at the moms in the room and say, hang in there, try to schedule a bubble bath this week.
Which never actually helps.
No, it never does. Instead, he actually offered a deeply counterintuitive antidote to all this modern madness.
He did, but to understand why his antidote makes any sense at all, we first have to like agree on the definition of the sickness, right?
Right.
So Kent organized this around two opposing forces, margin and madness, and he defined margin simply as that part of your life where you can do whatever you want.
Like the unassigned capacity.
Exactly, the unassigned capacity. And then he pointed out how that margin is just being violently eroded by what he calls the madness, the endless texts, the mandatory overtime, the relentless social expectations.
Yeah, and to give us a really visceral picture of what that madness feels like when it just completely takes over, Kent shared this hilarious story from his early days of parenting.
Oh my gosh, this story.
Right. So he and his wife, Jenny, had four kids, all under the age of four.
Which, I mean, is a logistical nightmare under the best of
A
circumstances.
complete nightmare. So Jenny decides to take a part-time job, and Kent figures, I can easily handle things at home.
Of course he does.
Right, because his schedule as a pastor has some flexibility. So he volunteers to be the stay-at-home dad for like 3 hours every afternoon.
And how did that go?
Well, he admitted that it took him exactly 30 minutes to realize he was completely in over his head.
I believe it.
Yeah, he's got diapers piling up everywhere. One of the kids is yelling from the bathroom, so Kent resorts to literally throwing Cheerios into the toilet for target practice just to like keep them occupied.
Oh, wow.
All while trying to break up a toddler sword fight in the hallway. And eventually, he just ends up literally pinned to the living room floor by four toddlers.
It paints quite a picture,
It
honestly.
really does.
But underneath the humor of that image, it perfectly captures that very real sensation of being overrun. I mean, it's that moment you realize the demands of your environment have completely surpassed your ability to manage them.
Yeah. I was thinking about his definition of margin, and it struck me that margin isn't just free time.
Right.
Think about like the physical white space on a page of a printed book. Those blank edges are the margins. If the author decided to print words all the way to the very edges, like top to bottom, side to side, the book would become literally unreadable.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Thanks. Yeah, your eyes would have nowhere to rest and the text would just blur together. So the madness Kent is talking about isn't just being busy, it's us taking a pen and frantically writing over our own margins until our lives become completely unreadable.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. And, if we look at the specific pressures driving us to write over those margins, especially for women and mothers, given the Mother's Day context, I mean, the societal pressure is
Oh,
immense.
100%.
From a very young age, society tells women, get perfect grades, excel at sports, prove you can operate in a male-dominated world without even breaking a sweat.
Right. And as adulthood hits, the expectations only compound.
Exactly. You are expected to break glass ceilings professionally. You're expected to calmly and pleasantly handle it when someone mansplains your own expertise back to you.
Ugh.
And then you open your phone, and the expectation is that your home should look like a meticulously curated social media feed.
The social media trap is brutal. Like, you watch a 30-second video of someone effortlessly renovating their living room, or a family driving to church with all their kids beautifully singing in perfect harmony in the back seat. Meanwhile, you're just trying to get out the door without someone spilling juice all over their shirt.
The contrast is just punishing. It creates this persistent illusion that everyone else has figured out a way to manage the madness effortlessly. But Kent stripped away that illusion to expose the fundamental math problem we are all dealing with. It's an equation, really. Our burden of responsibility drastically outweighs our resources.
Basically, the weight of the obligations we're required to carry is fundamentally heavier than our internal human capacity to carry it.
Exactly.
Okay, so if I'm looking at that equation where my responsibilities are way higher than my resources, the logical, practical answer would be to balance it out, right?
You would think so.
Like, either I need to acquire more resources, like hiring help or making more money, or I need to cut my responsibilities. Drop a commitment, take a vacation, do less. But Kent doesn't suggest either of those things. He takes a massive swerve here.
He really does, because simply telling an overwhelmed person to do less is often impossible advice. I mean, you can't just stop parenting, and you can't just start paying your mortgage.
So Kent suggests that the antidote to burnout, like the actual cure for this lack of margin, is discipleship. And honestly, when he said that, my first reaction was, wait, how does that help?
It sounds counterintuitive.
Because if I'm already drowning in tasks, how does adding a religious commitment like discipleship reduce the madness?
It definitely sounds like adding another heavy item to the to-do list. But Ken explained it by reframing what discipleship actually means. He told this story about trying to get a well fixed on his property.
Oh, the well guy.
Yeah, the well guy. He called the only well expert he could find in Kentucky, didn't like the guy's answer, so he tracked down an expert in Tennessee. And Kent tells the Tennessee guy, "Hey, you should just move up to Kentucky. You'd have a total monopoly."
And the guy just laughs.
Right. The guy laughs and explains why there are so few well experts. To learn the trade, you have to complete multiple grueling 2-year apprenticeships. You literally just shadow a master for 2 years to learn one specific component, and then you do it all over again for the next component.
It's an exhaustive process of just watching someone who already knows what they are doing.
Yes. You aren't building the well yourself on day one. You are carrying the tools, watching the master's technique, observing how they handle problems. And Kent argued that this is precisely what discipleship is. It is apprenticing under Jesus.
So it's not about memorizing more theology or attending more events. It's an apprenticeship in how to live.
Exactly. And there is a crucial distinction here that we often miss in modern church culture. Kent pointed out the difference between being saved and being a disciple. Because in many circles, getting someone saved is treated as the ultimate finish line. You know, you prayed the prayer, you are in the club, you're good. But getting saved merely establishes the relationship. Discipleship is the ongoing daily apprenticeship of learning how to actually pace your life. Jesus's parting instructions weren't go get people saved, they were go and make disciples.
Which means learning how to do life from the master. And that leads directly into Matthew 11:28-30, which Kent leaned on heavily. Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest."
Which is such a comforting verse.
It really is. He's speaking directly to you, the listener, the tired parent, the employee working a 60-hour week, the person navigating a terrifying health diagnosis. But then Jesus follows that up with, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me."
And we really need to pause right here, because to a modern ear, the word yoke is highly problematic.
Oh, completely.
I mean, a yoke is a physical restraint. It's a heavy wooden beam placed across the necks of working animals to force them to pull a plow. So if someone is already exhausted and drowning in their responsibilities, offering them a heavy wooden yoke sounds less like an antidote and more like an insult.
That was exactly my thought. Why on earth would I want a yoke? If I'm tired, give me a pillow, not farm equipment.
Right. But to understand the offer, you have to understand first-century agriculture. When a farmer was plowing a massive, difficult field, they would never yoke two young, energetic oxen together.
Why not?
Well, because the young oxen have a ton of energy, but absolutely no pacing. They would sprint out of the gate, pull frantically, and completely burn themselves out before the field was even halfway done.
Oh, that makes sense.
So instead, the farmer yokes a young, inexperienced, frantic ox with an older, much stronger, heavily experienced ox.
So the older ox is basically carrying the younger one.
It bears the brunt of the weight, yes, but its primary job is pacing. When that young ox tries to sprint ahead in a total panic, the physical wood of the yoke pulls it back. It literally forces the young ox to slow down and match the steady, sustainable rhythm of the older ox.
Wow.
It restrains the panic so the animal can actually survive the entire field.
Okay, that completely changes the metaphor. So when Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you," he isn't handing us another task. He's saying, "Strap yourself to me."
Yes.
He is the older, experienced ox.
Yeah.
So when our lives devolve into madness and we start sprinting in sheer panic trying to fix everything, his presence in the yoke pulls us back. He slows us down to a sustainable pace.
He dictates the rhythm.
Yeah.
And that is why apprenticeship is the real antidote to burnout. When you share the yoke, you are no longer responsible for resourcing the entire field all by yourself. You are trusting the master's pace.
But, you know, how does trusting that pace actually look when things are actively exploding around you?
It's hard.
Yeah, because it's one thing to talk about pacing on a quiet Sunday morning, but it's another when your life is in actual chaos.
For sure.
But Kent addressed this by pivoting to a very raw, recent crisis in his own life.
Mm.
He described his last year as feeling like driving a naval boat through a minefield.
That's a heavy description.
Just relentless explosions, one crisis after another. It got to the point where the stress was keeping him awake at night. The pressure of his responsibilities completely eclipsed his resources. And during one of those sleepless nights, he found himself reading the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000.
Which is a narrative we've all heard so many times that we tend to just skim it. We know the ending, the bread multiplies, so we completely ignore the profound tension of the setup.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
I usually just skip straight to the miracle part. But Kent painted the historical and emotional background of that specific day, and it is incredibly intense.
It really is.
Jesus's cousin, John the Baptist, who Kent affectionately called Johnny B, had just been murdered by King Herod. And it wasn't just an execution. It was this grotesque spectacle.
Very grotesque.
Herod, who was a deeply corrupt and bizarre ruler, throws a banquet. His niece dances for him, and Herod is so pleased he offers her anything she wants. And prompted by her mother, she asks for John the Baptist's head on a platter as a party favor.
It is a dark, politically charged, and emotionally devastating event. John was a major prophetic figure, but to Jesus, he was family. And Jesus, you know, operating fully as a human being who experiences grief, he needs to step away and mourn.
Right. So Jesus gets into a boat with his closest friends to retreat to a solitary place. He just needs a break. But the crowd see where the boat is heading and run along the shore to meet him. When Jesus steps out of the boat, instead of finding quiet margin, he is met by 5,000 men.
And Kent made a vital historical note here. This wasn't just a random group of families out for a Sunday picnic. This was likely a militia.
A militia.
Yeah. They knew John the Baptist had just been executed by a corrupt regime, and they were riled up, angry, and potentially ready to fight.
So Jesus steps out of the boat, deep in personal grief, desperately needing rest, and walks directly into a volatile, demanding mob. I mean, the burden placed on him in that exact moment is unimaginable. Yet, the scripture explicitly notes that he had compassion on them.
But this is the part of the story that always confused me, and Kent really zeroed in on it. Jesus looks at this massive, hungry crowd, and he turns to his disciple, Philip, and he asks Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?"
Right.
Now, Jesus already knows that they are out in the middle of nowhere. He knows they only have 5 loaves and 2 fish. If Jesus already knows what he is going to do, why put Philip on the spot? It feels almost like a trap. Why assign Philip a task that Jesus mathematically knows is impossible?
It's the pivotal moment of the entire narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you look closely at John 6.6, the text explicitly answers your question. It says Jesus asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Yeah, Jesus wasn't crowdsourcing a catering solution here. He was testing Philip's dependency. He wanted to see exactly how Philip would react when his real-world responsibility instantly and massively outweighed his available resources.
And Philip fails the test immediately. He doesn't look at Jesus. He looks at his wallet. He instantly starts doing the math, saying, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite."
He starts crunching the numbers.
Exactly. Then Andrew chimes in, bringing over a kid with a Lunchable, 5 small barley loaves, and 2 small fish, basically saying, "This is literally all the inventory we have." They were acting out exactly what Kent called being a practical atheist.
That phrase, practical atheist, is likely going to be the central talking point in your Connect groups this week,
mm-hmm.
because it's a profoundly challenging concept.
Very much so.
A practical atheist isn't someone who denies God exists. It is someone who claims to follow God, who attends church, who agrees with the theology. But the absolute second a real-world crisis hits, the moment their responsibility outweighs their resources, they operate as if God is nowhere to be found.
Oof. Practical atheist.
That is a really heavy, uncomfortable label. You're saying that even if I'm sitting in the pews at Harmony every single Sunday, the moment I get a scary letter from the IRS or my teenager starts acting out, and my immediate reaction is to panic, lose sleep, and try to fix it entirely on my own.
Right.
In that moment, I'm acting like God doesn't exist.
Precisely. It is when your functional reality completely disconnects from your stated theology. You immediately try to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, you run the scenarios, you hyperventilate over the math, and you completely forget who is standing right next to you in the yoke.
Which brings up a very common phrase we hear all the time when people are stressed out.
Hmm.
Kent brought up that old cliche, God will never give you more than you can handle.
Oh, it's stitched onto throw pillows everywhere. It really is. And Kent absolutely destroyed it. He said, if someone tries to offer you that cliche when you're overwhelmed, you have his full permission to give them his grandma's eye roll.
I love that.
Because it's completely factually false. Life and God will constantly give you significantly more than you can handle on your own.
It has to be false.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you possess the internal capacity to handle every single problem, trauma, and deficit that came into your life, you wouldn't actually need a savior. You would just need a better day planner.
So true. So the fact that we are constantly placed in situations that are too heavy for us isn't a mistake. It is designed to force us out of our practical atheism. When the math doesn't work, it forces us to insert the phrase, but God, into our panic.
Yes. I don't have enough money to cover this medical bill, but God. I don't know how to repair my marriage. But God.
Exactly. It pushes us to stop relying on our own inadequate resources and instead lean heavily into the yoke with the older ox.
It forces the apprenticeship. And, you know, we should be clear. Turning to God in these moments doesn't mean the problem instantly evaporates. Jesus never promised a life devoid of trouble. He promised his peace amidst the trouble.
Right.
The goal of Philip's test wasn't just to miraculously feed people. The goal was to see if Philip would turn to the master when he hit the absolute end of his own rope.
To bring this all down to earth, Kent shifted from the massive scale of a 5,000-man militia to a very quiet domestic scene. Because let's face it, most of our days aren't life or death crises. They are just chaotic Tuesdays. So he looked at the story of two sisters, Mary and Martha.
It serves as the perfect micro example of the macro problem.
It really does. Jesus comes to their house to visit, and Martha immediately goes into overdrive. She is running around the kitchen, and Kent painted this great, relatable picture of her frantically making deviled eggs and salsa.
Yes, desperately trying to host the Messiah perfectly.
Exactly. She is entirely consumed by the madness of her responsibilities. Meanwhile, her sister Mary is completely absent from the kitchen. She is just sitting on the floor at Jesus' feet, listening to him.
You can just imagine the cultural and internal pressure Martha is feeling. Hosting a rabbi was a massive social duty. She is feeling the exact crush we've been talking about. Her responsibilities are outweighing her resources, and she finally snaps. She demands that Jesus intervene and tell Mary to get up and help her with the work.
But Jesus doesn't send Mary to the kitchen. Instead, he gently rebukes Martha. He tells her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her.
Martha was operating entirely as a practical atheist in her own kitchen. She genuinely believed that the success of the evening rested solely on her ability to hustle and resource the event herself.
While Mary, however, chose the margin, she actively chose the apprenticeship. She recognized a fundamental truth. The presence of the master is infinitely greater than the pressure of the tasks.
The presence of the master is greater than the pressure of the tasks. I mean, that is the core of it all right there. As you get ready to sit down with your Connect group this week, we really want you to genuinely examine your own routines through this lens.
Yeah, because this isn't just some abstract theological debate about first century agriculture.
Right. This applies directly to how you handle your overflowing email inbox tomorrow morning. It applies to how you react when your toddler has a very public meltdown in the grocery store. It dictates where your mind goes during those 3 a.m. moments of pure anxiety.
The question you have to answer is, when the pressure hits, do you default to practical atheism? Do you frantically try to balance an impossible equation using only your own limited energy? Or do you choose the apprenticeship, slip your shoulders into the yoke, and allow Jesus to dictate the pace of your life?
We have to stop assuming that we are supposed to have enough resources on our own.
Yeah.
We have to ditch the madness and just embrace the yoke.
And, you know, if we really take Pastor Kent's message to heart, it leads to a paradigm shift I'd like to leave you with today. We establish that God specifically uses our moments of being utterly under-resourced as an invitation to yoke with him.
Right, because our inability to handle it forces us to rely on him.
Exactly. So if that is true, could it be that the very areas of your life where you feel like you are failing the hardest right now, like the specific places causing you the most shame, the most anxiety, and the most exhaustion, are actually the exact places you are most primed for spiritual growth?
Oh, wow.
What if your absolute lack of capacity isn't a bug in your life's operating system, but a deliberate feature designed to draw you closer to the master?
Wow. If our failure is a feature, not a bug, that changes how we view literally every struggle we have. It means the feeling of being overwhelmed isn't the end of the story. It's the precise starting point of the cure. Keep that question in mind as you head into your Connect groups this week, Harmony Christian Church. We will see you next time.